Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, maybe you heard some of his story last week. Marine on Guadalcanal turned aerial gunner turned fighter pilot. He'll share more of his close calls and give us a few laughs as well.
Here we always say, you pilots are expendable. Bring the airplanes back.
He's 93 and still going strong. Catch the rest of this Valley veteran's unique and remarkable story today at 1 on News Talk 580 1059. Brought to you by Morrison's RV Parts and Service at 180 and Academy in Sanger.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you, men and women who have done incredible things for the sake of our freedom. Could be your next door neighbor, maybe the guy you wave to when you drive down the street. Or how about the one that you buy fresh eggs from at a roadside stand? If you live in Fresno, California, it very well could be that last man I described. And you already know that if you caught our program last time when we got to know 93-year-old Augie Palercio. If you missed it, you can find everything we discussed in the podcast at hometownheroesradio.com, and you'll find plenty of photos of Augie there, too. I just wasn't able to fit all of his stories into that 1 hour, and we left out one of the more incredible ones, so we're going to get to that today and also explore a little more of his service with the U.S. Marine Corps during World War II. A few months ago, Augie was able to visit the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., thanks to Central Valley Honor Flight, part of the National Honor Flight Network. And one thing I hear over and over again from the families of veterans who take that trip is how cathartic it is, how much it means to these veterans, even how much more energy the veterans have afterwards, and how experiencing that together with other vets often enables them to talk about the things they may have never discussed before with their families. Wherever you're listening today, there is an Honor Flight hub near you, I promise. So I hope you'll encourage the World War II veterans in your life to apply for this all-expenses-paid journey. The veterans don't pay a dime. And as far as I'm concerned, from what I can tell, from what I've seen, it is the absolute best way to show our veterans just how much we appreciate their service and sacrifice. I'll share a little more about one in particular that's coming up before we're done today, but let's get back into Augie Palercio's story. He joined the Marine Corps shortly after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and within months was headed to Guadalcanal, where he'd serve as a machine gunner with the 1st Marine Division. And it hit me, I've interviewed hundreds of World War II veterans over the last decade, but very few who were really involved in the fighting on the ground at Guadalcanal, the first major Allied offensive against the Japanese in World War II. Augie was involved in that on the ground. And if you heard the show last week, you heard him discuss the multiple battles to control Guadalcanal's bloody knoll. More than 7,000 Allied troops died on Guadalcanal, and Augie saw more of those than he'd like to remember. Once the Allies controlled the airstrip that the Japanese had been building there, the 1st Marine Air Wing arrived and named that airstrip Henderson Field in honor of Major Lofton Henderson, a Marine Corps pilot who had been killed while bombing a Japanese carrier at the Battle of Midway a couple months earlier. Augie Palercio would end up flying from Henderson Field as a rear-facing gunner in an SBD Dauntless. On our last program, he kind of skipped over a lot of those gunner adventures and jumped ahead to his pilot days, but one of those early missions as a gunner earned him the Distinguished Flying Cross and a Purple Heart. So I want to backtrack to that time period. What do you remember about being a gunner on those SBDs?
My first pilot that I flew with as a gunner, he had 9 hours in the air. That is all. Just 9 hours. That's not very many hours. And I was in the back seat. And I had more time in the air than he did, but he was a college man.
Right.
So he was a second lieutenant, and I was a buck private. So I was always trying to look to see whether he was doing what I thought was the right thing. I was happening to be looking over my right shoulder to see him, and I could see bullets hitting the water right in front of us. So while I was looked back, here was this biplane. I don't know the name of it, but it was a biplane with two wings. And it, when I first saw it, it looked like a Grumman duck. If you ever see a Grumman duck, that's what it looked like. And he was a pretty smart pilot. So as soon as I saw him, my guns were right there, so I turned loose on him. And to get away, he got underneath the tail. So I yelled to the pilot to get the tail out of the way, or I'm going to have to shoot it off because he's under it. So he was fishtailing it, trying to get it away from it. And he was back there doing the same thing, staying underneath. That's the safest place. Stay under the. But for some reason or other, they got their turnings and off. So here he was, right out in the open. Boy, and I let him have it with both 30s. We were using twin 30s in the back seat. And I caught him dead center. He finally peeled off, but he's not only smoking, but as he went down, I could see flames coming up. Of course, we didn't stay around and watch it. We were going home.
Sure. So you didn't tell me about any Purple Hearts. How many Purple Hearts you got? How many times were you wounded?
Just one. But the shrapnel is still in there. I mean, but the last few times you go through, like you're going to court in Fresno, you have to go through this metal detector. Yeah. And if you're being a smart aleck, you don't ever tell them. So you go through it and that light lights up and everybody starts running. So you take your shirt off, you take your jacket off, go through it. Pretty soon it dawned on them that there was something wrong. So they let you go.
So where is it? It's in your arm?
Yeah, this hand right here. Mm-hmm. You used to be able to see the scar, but I looked the number of times and don't see it anymore.
What happened? Tell me about what happened, how you got hurt.
On one of the hits, part of the shell, of course, there's always anti-aircraft shells that are like little bombs going off. A piece of shrapnel got into it, and that's about all. No special deal on it. I don't know what to tell you.
Well, was this the same time that you had to land the plane when you were the gunner?
I was shot down once. Yeah, that was when I was in the water.
Now, there was another time that you were the gunner, but the pilot was shot and you had to take over and land the plane?
Oh, yeah, no, I didn't tell you about that. Yeah, no, that was, I was in the back seat.
Yeah.
And that was right after I got into the Marine Air Wing. I come over from the division.
Yeah.
We were going out and he got shot. And if he was still alive, you could see a big hole in the back of his right shoulder, where the shell went off, and that's when this happened. But it was no big deal to me because, I mean...
No big deal to you, but you're riding backwards in an SBD. Your pilot's so hurt he can't fly the plane. Yeah. How do you even get into the pilot seat? That can't be easy.
You don't. All I had in the back seat was just a stick. Uh-huh. I didn't have a throttle control. I didn't have any rudders. All I had was a stick.
And you're facing the wrong way.
With a gunner's belt, you can stand up and turn around. Because these garter belts, you stand up and turn around.
Uh-huh.
And then most of the times, you very seldom sit down.
Right.
Because you could move and see better standing up. Even while it's in a dive, you always have something that you can lean against. So it's no big deal.
So I'm sure the plane was damaged too, right?
Oh, yeah, no, the plane was shot up, but the pilot got credit for that flight, not me.
But without you, the pilot wouldn't have made it.
Well, that's all in the day's work.
So you are in the rear-facing gunner seat, standing up, trying to see the front. You've got no throttle control, just a stick, and you landed the plane. Where'd you land?
Well, very easily. Of course, I didn't have any landing gear, so you're just coming in for a landing, and you drag the tail, and you put the tail down first, and that slows you down, and it flops down.
So you landed on land or on a carrier?
On land. We were working off of Guadalcanal. That was right after I got into the 1st Marine. The 1st Marine moved in on the Guadalcanal.
So you had to belly land the plane with no landing gear. You weren't even a pilot, and you were in the wrong seat, and you still found a way to land the plane. And you don't think that's a big deal?
It wasn't.
That's insane. It's incredible. How many other guys do you think did that?
I don't know.
You think any other gunners did that?
Not that I know of, but I don't know.
Had you ever had to land a plane like that before without gear?
Yeah. One of the times when we came back, before I got into the fighters, I was still in the SBDs. So we came back to the States to get new airplanes. And we got the SB-2C. Yeah. It was strictly an all-electric airplane, everything electric. So it was out on a familiar flight, and the power went off. Battery was no good. And so we had to land it with, I had a stick and throttle, all right, but I had no controls over it. And so it was at El Toro, and there was a long runway, so you just come in slow, and the same thing. Put the tail down first, and then one gear. Then as it settles, let the other gear down, and pretty soon it'll slow down. Well, this time I was having to come in so fast that I couldn't control it, that I was going to run off the end of the runway at El Toro. And I thought to myself, well, I could ground loop it and maybe get a wingtip, probably like that. Or I could run off into that plowed field, and maybe I'll have to get, I might get a prop because it'll come up like that. So anyway, I decided I could do less damage for sure by landing it in the field. Right at the end of the runway, some farmer that was farming that wheat or barley, he dug a drain ditch. And so when the landing gear hit this ditch, it come up like this and went over, and I was trapped inside, and as they came up, they dug a hole, and I crawled out through that hole underneath it. And when I turned loose of the belt to come out, I fell and landed on my head. That's my excuse for being a knucklehead.
I guess so.
Well, it's something funny, though.
Yeah.
It was coming along here, and when I knew I was going to go over, I had a hot date that night, a real hot one. And as I was coming up like that, oh, no, I'm going to miss out on my date. So they take me off into sick bay, and they're going to keep me here. And I said, no, you're not. Anyway, so surgeon, he went off. Nobody was around, so I put my pants on and left.
You had that hot date after all?
Oh, yeah. God, I couldn't miss out on that.
All right, so that was the only other time that you had belly landed a plane, and now you're having to land this SBD overseas without any landing gear. You keep saying it's no big deal, but were you scared? Were you afraid that wasn't going to work out so well?
Was I scared?
Yeah.
I don't think I was smart enough to know the word scared. I'm telling you,
yeah.
And no, I don't think I was smart enough, because it worries, rest assured, it worries me now. This time I was playing the game chicken. You know, the kids play it today with cars. Well, we got into this dogfight, and we ended up going this way at each other, and I knew I wasn't going to give in to him. And I was indicating about 300, so I assumed he was doing the same. So we were closing at 600. So my idea was, as we got at right at the last minute, I'm gonna flip my airplane over like this and catch his wing with my prop as I went by. Well, as we were coming this way, just about the time I was supposed to flip my airplane, he blew the canopy off of my airplane. And I blew his oil filter off. So then he went home, I went home.
That's close enough.
Well, after it was all over with, I was talking to the LSO, once in a while you find a commissioned officer that's a human being, and he happened to be one. And I said, when I was coming downwind, you weren't very positive with your flags. See, yeah, I couldn't make up my mind if I'd have you land on the ship, on the carrier, or have you ditch it in the water, because you were shot up so bad you didn't think you could make it. He said, well, I'm sure glad you decided I could make it.
Yeah. We might not be sitting here talking otherwise. And you had to land on a beach one time?
On the beach? Yeah, one time. Yeah, I don't know. Let's see. It was Guadalcanal, Russell, on Monday Beach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that a little hairy?
I had to land it as oil pressure. Yeah. And I was afraid I couldn't make it back to either the carrier or to the field on the Guadalcanal. So they tell me they just junked the airplane. So I don't know. But the airplane, as far as I'm concerned, wasn't hurt. I didn't hurt it in landing it. It was...
You had a smooth landing on the beach?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sandy beach. The thing is, you've got to be real careful because your landing gear can sink in and you know what's going to happen to the tail, don't you? So you want to be sure you've got the thing down slow. And speed always comes into effect. And usually it's too much speed. The only time you never have enough of speed when you're going in on a hit. I don't know how many times I would go in on a strike and the throttle would be on the peg, the mixture control would be on the peg, the RPMs would be on the peg. And I was praying to God.
On the beach landing, Did you scare anybody off the beach?
Did I scare everybody off? Well, most of them were Japanese. I don't know whether I scared them or the guys in the air still scared them anyway. Pretty soon a PT boat come up the slot. And they pulled in there and I walked out this deep in water and we finally got me on it.
Well, that was my question. Was it safe to be on that beach? Was that a safe place to be?
No, not yet. No, it was an enemy beach, yeah. But see, the way the island is shaped comes like that. Well, the runway was over here. And, of course, this is all beach. And where I landed was this end of it on the beach. I came in as though I was going in on the airstrip. But I didn't have enough of control to do it, and then I was afraid. So I landed it, and I landed it long. So I ended up, who got the airplane, I really don't know.
But you had to get out of there as fast as you could.
Oh, yeah, no, a PT boat picked me up, yeah. Because, you know, when you're going in like that, say, for instance, you've got Europe at 15,000 feet, just a figure. And most of the times, you very seldom ever try to descend more than 1,000 feet a minute. If you have any control, you maintain that. So from here to here is 15 minutes. And that's a long, long 15 minutes. Because when you get here, you never know whether you're going to be alive, dead, or a prisoner. And that's a long 15 minutes.
Yeah, it sure is. We need to catch a break. And I don't know about you, but to me, it sure seems like the more dangerous and insane the situation Augie was in, the more nonchalantly he describes it. I sure can't imagine being in his shoes. When we come back, we're going to explore what it was like for Augie to fly an F4U Corsair. And if you want to check out some photos of him back in the 1940s or what he looks like today, visit hometownheroesradio.com or just hop on Facebook and type in Hometown Heroes Radio. Right back with more of Augie Palercio's story right after this.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, where the idea is always to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so current and future generations of their families and ours will know and won't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. Well, we learn a lot. I know I do. I learn something new every week. So you could say we're educated, we're certainly entertained, and many times we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It's not too often that a veteran story gets spread across two episodes of Hometown Heroes, but that's the case this time with 93-year-old Augie Palercio of Fresno, California. If you check out his photo gallery on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll see what an SBD Dauntless dive bomber looks like and how Augie would have experienced his 43 missions as a rear-facing gunner in those SBDs. He would eventually fly those planes, too, as well as the F-4U Corsair. His hearing isn't what it used to be, and sometimes his memory gets a little fuzzy, but he didn't hesitate when I asked him this question. How did it feel in a dive bomber in that gunner seat, diving straight down where you can't see where you're going? Did you like being the pilot better?
Oh, much better, much, much. When you're there and you know when you have to be real careful about enemy planes. Yeah. Well, if you're in a dive practically straight down, if an enemy plane is trying to stay with you, it's just about impossible. I say that because in practice, we used to practice that. The leader would roll over, pull down, and the wingman couldn't stay with him. Going down like that, the gunner is, in most cases, if he's using the seat belt, he's strapped in. But sometimes the gunner won't use a seat belt because this garter belt that he wears, you know, it's a belt like this here, then it has two legs. The two legs are clamped to the side of the airplane, and you can stand up, move around, but you can't take any G's slowing down. Standing up, you're out. If you better do something besides standing there.
What was the carrier that you flew off of? Was it the same carrier the whole time or more than one?
One was a Ranger and one was a Wright. And as a dumb old man, I keep getting them mixed up in my head. And they're both at the bottom of the ocean. Now, when I say carriers, they're not like the carriers we have today. Today, they're 2-3 football field lengths. Yeah. The one I was on was 700 feet. Uh-huh. And in that 700 feet, all you had to work with was half of that because the other half had airplanes getting stacked on it ready to go. Right. And the thing is, when you land, you better grab the first or second hook. Otherwise, you're going to run into the barrier. And the barrier, what the barrier is, it has sometimes 3 and sometimes 4 cables stretched across the deck. Right. So if you miss the hook and your brakes never could stop you, yeah, you're going to get wrapped up. And the dangerous part is when a plane hits that barrier, about 100 sailors come out and throw the airplane over the side because they might have 4 or 5 more planes wanting to come in out of fuel. And you could sacrifice one to save 6, maybe. So that's why they would always say, tell us, you pilots are expendable. Bring the airplanes back.
That's reassuring, isn't it?
At the time, it was just a joke.
Most of us have never flown a Corsair. What did that feel like? What did you like about the F4U?
Oh, it was a mean airplane. It was when I say mean, you do what you wanted to do. Lots of people didn't like the course there. One time we were on duty at El Toro, as well, it was still a base, and we're night flying. And some reason or other, they put this major on my wing, and that's a no-no. Rank leads. You don't care whether it's good or bad, rank leads. Yeah. Well, he wouldn't take the lead. He just signaled no, so nothing I could do. So we landed, and he came over, and there again, I was an enlisted man. Right. And we got to talking, and I was afraid that he was going to really do something to make me quit flying or something. Yeah. So I couldn't handle that. But then after our chit-chat, he said, Palercio, what do you think of that airplane? Right away, I knew what was his problem. I said, well, I think it's the best I've seen. The only thing that was better and all I've had was one flight, and it was the F-8 Bearcat. It never did see service, but it was a real airplane. And I finally said, well, Major, if I may, why do you ask me that? You had a problem? You'd held position real good while we were up there. It must have been a training flight for him. And you were holding position real good. Every time I gave a signal, you responded. Plersio, it doesn't have enough engines. Just that simple. A multi-engine pilot can't handle a single engine. Yeah. Well, as a civilian, I owned a, still have it. I gave it to my son, a twin-engine Cessna 310 turbocharged. And I liked it very well because I always liked an ace in a hole.
Yeah.
And that second engine was the ace in my hole.
You never had that luxury in the war. You mentioned being a test pilot or doing some test flights. Were there some other airplanes that you had to test out?
One of the tours, the duties, I was stationed at El Toro, and there was another Corsair squadron there that mostly new pilots. And you always need a test pilot. When a pilot writes on the yellow sheet that oil pressure fluctuating or temperature gets too high, after you fix it, you got to test it. That's where the test pilot comes in. You got extra pay for that because that test flight could be your death.
Extra pay for extra guts.
That's right.
Well, and never were guts and faith required more than the time Augie was shot down and had to be pulled out of the water. We heard about it last time, but maybe you missed that. And if so, you're going to need the context for other things we're going to discuss in a bit. So here is part of that account from Augie's days as a dive bomber pilot.
And of course, I had a gunner in the back seat. And you know, that poor boy was, I don't think he was 17 years old. Evidently, he stopped in any aircraft shell with his chest. And of course, it blew the plane out of control. So we landed it in the water. As I was trying to get him out of the cockpit, back seat, he had his gunner's belt on, and I don't know if you know what a gunner's belt is, but it's like a garter belt that girls wear to hold their stockings up, I think. And I had trouble trying to get him out, and while I was doing that, I could see his chest was wide open. It was all, he was dead, shot dead center. The shell must have went off right in back of him. Of course, he was facing the rear. And so we got in the water. I tried to get him out. And the plane was going down, I think about 10 feet. I run out of air. I come up for air and I went back down. I couldn't find it. I lost it. So I lost him. And I spent, they tell me, about 4 hours. The last couple of hours probably, I wasn't all myself. It's hard to find anybody or anything that's down in the water with the white caps. They all look the same, no matter what you do. I was about ready to give up. I'd been in there for I don't know how long, 2 hours, 3 hours. I was wearing my way west, but like everything else, I guess, the more you think about it, the more you think the May West is going south. That means the air is coming out of it, so I decided to make a one's out of my pants. They taught us in training how to take your pants off and tie the legs together and then shake it in the air and slam it in the water, and that traps a bunch of air in there, and that's another life jacket. Well, like a dumb kid, I had it all ready to slap it in the air, and I thought, well, golly, if some shark comes along and sees that little worm there, I'd be a goner. So I put my pants back on. And about the time for me to just give up and quit, because I couldn't see any use, then I saw a speck in the sky. It was a PBY Navy patrol plane. And evidently, not the pilot, somebody, some of the mechanics inside the airplane spotted me. And they told the pilot about it, and so he started to circle me, but I could tell he wasn't seeing me because he wasn't passing any signals on to me or anybody. Finally, he evidently saw me, and to acknowledge the fact that he saw me, he rocked his wings real hard. Sure enough, he got in the wind. He landed it. Now, some of the stuff they told me after I come to, he landed into the wind, but I do remember two sailors diving overboard. Even before PBY ever stopped, and pretty soon something was grabbing me.
They pulled him out of the water, still wearing a jacket that he says he never took off during his flying days. He still has it. You can find photos of it on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll talk about it when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch right after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping up two programs worth of discussion with a spirited 93-year-old named Augie Palercio. If you catch him at that roadside stand in Fresno where he sells produce and fresh eggs from all those chickens of his, ask him about his days in the Marine Corps, and maybe you'll even get a little more out of him than I have. I often mention on this program that Hometown Heroes can be educational, and I try to provide context when I can that puts these first-person accounts in perspective. But when I say I learn something new every week, here's an example. Have you ever heard of Operation Beleaguer before? Well, I hadn't either, but Augie was part of it. After the end of World War II, for nearly 4 years, American forces were in China trying to repatriate and evacuate foreign nationals, and hoping to broker a peace between Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists, and of course Mao Zedong and the communists. That peace never materialized. The Korean War would eventually ensue. But there were Americans killed in that interwar period. Augie, during that time, was flying Corsairs over China, and it was during this time that he lost his beloved wingman. You talked about McMasters, and I got the idea that you two were pretty close.
Mac, it was right there. He was a good, not only that, but he was a good pilot. Him and Teague was good. Teague and were both of them. I was the test pilot, and if there were two planes to be tested, I'd get one of them to, not at the same time, different times. And the way we tested them, we get up there and get into a dogfight. And the way you got into a dogfight, you got up to, say, 10,000 feet, and then the guy you're fighting with is down to 9,500. You come in like this, and the start of the fight is when you get one above the other, and then you go at it. Usually you go this way and he'll go this way, yeah. And you end up going straight down, and he's going straight down on his side. Only thing to do is to try to pull up, get your airplane up, and try to get in back of him. Because, no, we're not using lead. We're using gun cameras. Right. There's always a show to take the cameras into the ready room and play them up.
Was there some trash talking? Did you guys kid each other and tease each other and say, I'm better than you?
No. It was all friendly, but it was serious. I'm telling you, it was serious because we're both learning. My favorite trick was to dip the wings to the right, but then throw the airplane to the left. get on your back and start pulling out, and you go out, blackout. Yeah. But the airplane's all trimmed up, so when it turns over coming down, and then it straightens itself up, and you're coming straight up. So then you're pushing the blood up to your head.
I don't know if I could handle that. Well, I bring up McMaster's again, because you mentioned that he was killed while you were still flying over there. How was he killed, and how did that affect you?
Bad. They tell me I just about started the war over with, started a third world war with China. We were there patrolling the Yukes River to be sure China wasn't sending troops and ammunition over the river to North Korea. And that's where we just patrolled the river, just looking for troop movement. One time we had a pretty heavy load, both of us, and I could see he was having trouble keeping up, catching up to me, so the only thing I could do is throttle a little bit and then start a gentle left turn. That way that gave him a chance to cut inside of that turn. And so just as he came up, I signaled to him to get to my right wing. And as he went underneath me, come over here, evidently somebody fired a missile. They were probably aiming for my airplane, but about then I put it in the left turn, and it got Mac, and it blew him clear out of the sky. And I guess they say I must have went crazy, because that river and those salt, those rice paddies, they really caught hell that day. I was looking for, but I never did spot him. But that doesn't mean I had any ammo left over, because anything that moved was a target. And of course, that right after that, they shipped me back to the States. You had more than your share of war. Get out of here. So that was my last combat one. But we weren't at war with China. We weren't at war with North Korea. We were just being busybodies. And our orders were, you can't shoot unless you're being shot at and hit. It was a no-no to come back with a report that you fired your weapons. You didn't have any holes in the airplane. I was going to stay in, and Loris, that was my wife, it was okay for me to stay in, but she wanted me to quit flying. Golly, Loris, I can't do that. I'd never live. So I got out. And then the one and only time I ever really got into trouble with my wife, something else that you won't believe. I got into trouble with my wife, don't forget.
Well, I can't believe you only got into trouble once with your wife. That's the hard part to believe.
Just one time. And it wasn't over a woman. You'll never guess what it was for. I had too much money in my pocket. Before I got out, there was a lot of bootleg going on in the service. We'd fly whiskey across the border, $50 a fifth, and then the Marine Corps was paying for it. Uh-huh. But I finally told her, and what made her, I don't know whether you can say mad or so upset with me, says, you lied to me. You tried to lie your way out of it. But instead of that, we went back out here to flying, and you were crop dusting. And you should have, if that's the case, you should have stayed in the Marine Corps. Anyway, I finally talked her out of it, and she stayed with me for 61 years.
Yeah, and there were a lot of things you had to survive just to make it home and marry her. On the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you will find a wedding photo of Augie and Loris. You two waited until after World War II to get married.
I know a number of times we talked about getting married. Well, she would bring it up, and I said, no, because I might not make it. And there's no need of you being a widow before you even...
Well, I only bring it up because... you've got three children and you've got grandchildren. And does that get your attention a little bit to think about that? That none of them would be here if you didn't survive all those things that you told me about in the war?
I don't know.
I'm sure it's not something you think about a lot.
I was thinking about them while I was existing.
Yeah. Well, I think they're pretty thankful you made it home. A couple other things. Were there some pilots that you really looked up to? Guys that you thought were really heroic or brave or skilled?
Oh, yeah. You know, I can't brag enough about Teague or McMaster's. They were good pilots. that when I signaled we were going to attack those, just the two of us were going to attack those seven or eight Japanese fighters and bombers. They finally saw that we were going to, so fine, they did their job. But once we got out of the airplanes on the ground, then it was just two individuals. And you can say whatever you want to, right or wrong, it made no difference. He let me know what he thought.
Yeah, you told me about that, that he said it was no fun being brave, and maybe he added in an extra word or two that we can't air on the radio. You know, I've added a video on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page of Augie walking us through the flight suit that he still has and all the different elements of it. But let's talk about it here on the radio.
Don't ask me about this flight suit, Jack. That's a G suit. If you don't know what I mean, that's okay.
Explain it to us.
I stole it from the Navy. I was assigned to one of the carriers, either the Ranger or the Wright. And by then, I was a buck sergeant. And I got acquainted with a chief in the Navy chief. He was a pilot, and he was wearing one. And I asked him about it, and he says, you guys don't have them yet. It's just strictly a Navy issue. And I said, can we buy one? Buy one. Where would I get the money if he'd have said yes? But we asked him what we can do about getting one. He says, well, I can put one down, and you could pick it up and walk off with it. Take your chances on getting caught. So I did. Just that simple.
Well, hopefully the statute of limitations is up, and they won't be listening to this.
Yeah, well, if the Navy could find out the things that we got away with, boy, we'd never get out of it.
Well, let's talk about your jacket instead then, because I know you got that fair and square. The Marine Corps gave it to you. And you talk about standing the test of time. I know I've mentioned it more than usual today, but you really need to go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and see this photo of Augie with his jacket on. It's a photo that Gene Day took on the Central Valley Honor Flight trip to Washington, D.C. Augie is sitting in front of the Freedom Wall at the National World War II Memorial, where that array of gold stars represents the more than 400,000 Americans who never came home from World War II. And he's wearing this brown jacket that reminds Augie of how close he came to adding to that number. On the right breast of the jacket is a 70-year-old patch from Marine Scout Bomber Squadron 144. It features a shirtless Native American with a bomb tucked under his left arm. The number 144 is on the bomb, and a Sioux word is printed underneath it. Augie will tell us what that means. And on the other side of his jacket, it's another patch featuring a woman leaning forward off the angled wing of a Corsair. It says, Fighting 311 and Hell's Bells. That's Bells, B-E-L-L-E-S, thus the woman. When Augie returned from that honor flight, he had this very jacket on. And when I told the big crowd at Fresno Yosemite International Airport about the jacket's background, a really loud cheer went up and a grin stretched ear to ear on Augie's 93-year-old face. So look up the photo online, get a taste of what that jacket looks like. And of course, I had to ask Augie about what role that jacket played in the incident where he was shot down and had to be rescued from the water near Munda.
Wearing it in the water.
So you're wearing this flight jacket in the water.
Yeah.
What's the insignia there? The patch on your chest there? What does that signify?
Oh, this is the one for the dive bomber. That's the 144. That's the number of the squadron. And that Helsinki means warrior. And this other one over here, it was strictly a fighter squadron. It's 311. See, then I was in, as a test pilot, I was working with both squadrons, 311 and 312. Knowing Augie, I would always finagle flights in both.
So you had this jacket on. What's it made out of?
It was supposed to be goat skin. And I always maintain this is one of the best jackets I've ever owned. It always knew, as far as I'm concerned, if it was hot, it would keep me cool. If it was cold, it would keep me hot. Now, you don't have to believe that. That's okay with me. But it'll help me. That's that jacket.
So you survived all those hours in the water with that jacket on. And then you wore that on another flight you took a while back.
Yeah, no, abs that there dried out. I blew it every day.
And on the Central Valley Honor Flight, I saw you wearing that too. When you went to Washington, D.C.?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I was wearing it, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, when we were talking about it there again, one guy comes out and he says, yeah, and the amazing thing about it, Augie, it still fits you.
What does that jacket mean to you? When you look at it or you put it on, what does it remind you of?
Life or death, that jacket seemed more, there's no way of me telling you how much. I don't think once I got that jacket, I ever flew without it. Because especially in a dive bomber, you're in the open. You're always wearing underclothes. They weren't shorts. They were whole body ones. And that was for keeping you warm because it does get cold up there.
Going on the honor flight with all those other veterans to Washington, D.C., to see that World War II memorial with all those gold stars on it.
Yeah.
And you've told us about some of the guys that you lost, that Riddle the Gunner and Mac, your wingman. Were you thinking about those guys when you looked at all those gold stars?
Oh, yeah, sure, sure. It's an awful lot of men.
What did that trip mean to you? What did you get out of it?
Well, it helped way convince me that people do care. Lots of times, people don't care. It's been a long time since I've heard of somebody burning a flag. I hope I don't ever have to watch somebody do that. Like they accused me of starting World War III with China. I'd be starting a war with that guy one way or another. You don't have to have a weapon. When you're in the Marine Corps, what is your main job? Let's be real honest about it. My main job was to kill a man. Or in those days, there wasn't any women. Nowadays, it's you kill a man or a woman. You don't have to have a weapon to do it. And you're trained to do it. Yeah. That's why I think we have so many people turn out to be outlaws. I maintain that the way to stop all wars, get all the countries to agree to this, if the United States want to have a war with China, get the politicians from Washington and the politicians from China and put them on a big island, one on each side, and give them all the ammunition they want. Then at the end of 30 days, if either one of them wants a war, I'll join it.
Well, I have a feeling there is more than one veteran out there nodding his head in agreement with you on that one. Augie, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for sharing that one-of-a-kind story with us. Augie Palercio, 93 years old, and next time on Hometown Heroes, we're going to meet a man who was born and raised in the Philippines, joined the U.S. Army there before the Japanese attacked, ended up on the Bataan Death March, and escaped the death march with the help of some folks he certainly thinks of as heroes. He lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico now, and what a story he has. We're going to hear it next time on Hometown Heroes, but we're out of time for this episode. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you one more time that freedom is not free.